Welcome to the North and South of Things podcast, a show dedicated to discussion of topics important to the LGBT community and the community at large. Here are your hosts, Mark and George.
Hey, kids. Welcome to the North and South of Things. This is George in Atlanta.
And I'm Mark in St. Paul.
Welcome to our 25th episode and our one-year anniversary.
Happy anniversary, George.
Parties all around. Where's our beverage? It's early in the day for that. Mark and I started the podcast 1 year ago today. It was actually this live Pride 48 weekend that we debuted the show. So we've enjoyed the last year and thank all of you who have participated in the show with your feedback and comments and whatnot. And we also want to thank the Pride 48 team who make today's events possible. And we encourage all of you to dart over before we get in the mix of things and go over to pride48.com and hit that big purple button and donate to them. This can't go very far without financial help. So we appreciate all the hard work they do and encourage everybody to support them. And the other thing, Mark, that we love about doing the live event is the instant feedback from the chat room.
That's right. We have quite the crowd assembling as we speak. Joining us in the chat room today, we have Dan Pugh Hogan. We have Drew. We have the Faye Driver, Gavin, the Good Humor Penguin, Gravitas, IC Greg, Lawn Gnome Mags, Nowhere Chrissy has joined us. RT Cruiser from the future, Poppy Smelly, Veritable Virgo, Adam Burns, Michael Sage, John Ong, and PIMC John Goodman are idling.
I don't know who this PIMC John Goodman is, but he's been lurking all weekend long. We want to say congrats to Chubbs Gone Wild and the show before that, the Sawander and Judd movie review. I think that might be my first time listening to the Sawander and Judd movie review. I need to listen to that more. That was actually really, I enjoyed every minute of that. Mark, tell us a little bit about, we have this approach to our podcast that we most of the time talk about a single topic. Are we sticking to that today?
Yeah, we are. And we're kind of bringing out a very hot button issue. I know I certainly have been affected by the events that happened in Orlando, and it's been kind of forefront on my thinking all of this week. And so in order to honor our brothers and sisters and the LGBT members who died in Orlando, we're going to have a conversation about gun ownership and gun control in America. I think, I know, George, we talked earlier in the week, and this is something that you were incredibly passionate about and said that we had to talk about it. And I agreed with you, and so we've been preparing the show for most of the week, and it's been evolving. It's just been a whirlwind of a week when we're starting to talk about gun control. And a lot of the conversations that you hear are about, pro or con of gun ownership. And I think that kind of takes away, and what I'd like to start out with is a kind of putting this into a historical context. We are in America, guns are part of our culture and our history. And I think it would be good for us and our audience to kind of put this into a kind of a historical perspective and talk about our own experience with guns. And George, why don't you start out?
Yeah, I have to say, for me, guns have not been that big of an issue in my life. And Mark, we are getting that your mic level's a little high, which I don't seem to be able to control. For me, I think I had a pretty unnatural interaction with guns because I just didn't see them a lot until I was in my late teens. It was probably a good move that they weren't around our house. We had a little bit of an unstable household for much of my upbringing. But I did have a weekend with my brother-in-law who really turned out to be my only interaction with guns in my entire life. And it was sort of a long weekend visiting with my sister and my brother-in-law. And he had it set out in his mind he was going to teach us how to use a gun. And so we got to go out and shoot a .22 rifle and shoot, you know, target practice, basically, outside. What I didn't realize was that the next day we were going rabbit hunting. And, you know, killed a rabbit. It was awful, in a word. It just wasn't me. And it got right down to the point where I needed to pull the trigger to kill the rabbit, and I couldn't. And it didn't traumatize me or anything like that. I just realized it wasn't my thing. And mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, knocking on 50 years old, spending the last 15, 16 years of my life in Midtown Atlanta, working in downtown Atlanta, I've really never had that big of a desire to own a gun or even the need, despite living in a city that sometimes gets a knock for its crime. Despite that, I've really never had a compelling urge to go out and get a gun or take a class or anything like that. So for me, the experience with guns has been non-existent, but I will tell you, and I want to be clear about this, I don't consider myself anti-gun. I don't consider myself, I agree with the Second Amendment and its current interpretation, largely, mm-hmm. But I do feel very strongly about the assault weapons, which we'll get into a little bit later. I understand your experience as we prepped for the show a little bit different than mine.
Yeah, you know, living in Minnesota, which is the land of 10,000 lakes, you have a lot of sportsmen in the state. I grew up in a blue-collar, working-class family, and hunting and fishing were part of our family life. You know, ever since I was a kid, I would go fishing with my grandfather and my father and my uncles. And, you know, my uncles hunted deer in the fall. And it's sort of a rite of passage here in Minnesota where kids have, well, I don't want to say access to guns, but guns are part of what normal life is like. And so we are taught at a very young age gun safety. I know my brother, my sister, and myself all went through a gun safety class. And there are two things that were drilled into our heads during this class. And the first thing is you are taught to respect guns, and you are to treat every gun as a loaded gun, even if it isn't. You assume that it is. And the second thing is the safety on a gun is a mechanical device which can fail.
Wow.
And that was never made more sense to me. I remember very vividly of attending this gun safety class. And during the break, we went out and we had a soda. We had like 20 minutes. And I came back and I forgot to check my gun. And so we had to present our guns. And the instructor had turned off the safety. And he also put a blank .22 cartridge into the gun. So I am holding the gun as we're taught, kind of like you've seen the Minutemen holding their muskets in their arm, butt down to the ground, and, you know, safely not pointed at anyone. And the instructor came by and pressed my trigger, and the gun went off.
Wow.
And I have never forgotten that particular experience, but also, you know, it's guns. You have to treat them with respect.
You said earlier that that just taking the class, you know, when you were growing up, that was a rite of passage. Like that was it was almost like a sort of birthright. I mean, such an important milestone in your life when you got to take the class. You kind of, I guess, were becoming a man.
That's right. We couldn't have a BB gun or any sort of, we couldn't go hunting or anything like that until we had attended and passed the class. And, you know, I think I was probably somewhere between the ages of 10 and 12 at the time. And like I said, my whole family, my brother and my sister and myself took that class in order to kind of participate in, you know,
so did you
family outings.
So what was your first bunny killing?
Well, I've only been hunting once, and it was a small game hunting, and I was with my brother, and we were on my uncle's land in northern Minnesota, and we were walking through the forest, basically, and this squirrel came out, and it was sitting on a branch, and it was right in front of me. It wasn't very far away. It was probably maybe 60 feet. And it was chittering away and kind of screeching like squirrels are meant to do. And I just raised my shotgun, and it was probably, I think it was a 12 gauge, and shot the squirrel. And the squirrel fell to the ground, and it was dead. And it was like, that really was too easy. It didn't feel very sportsmanlike to me. The squirrel never had a chance.
They're anticlimactic, right? You
exactly. It was very anticlimactic.
Would it have been helpful if the squirrel had screamed out, "I've been shot! Oh, I'm dying!" No, we're kidding.
So after that, it's, you know, I just kind of lost interest in that, and you know, I just never felt compelled to go hunting ever again. But I do like wild game, such as venison and that sort of thing.
Not necessarily kill it, but you like its taste.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, and this is when we were kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, history has changed. We've got a lot of technology that's come along. And I think one of the key points of where this discussion about gun control, it starts with the Second Amendment.
Right.
And what I really am surprised about is the current, you know, we have this idea that it's my way or the highway, it's black or white, it's either this or that. There's no gray area.
Right.
There's no compromise. All of our opinions are very black and white. And as the case may be, nothing gets done. We see this playing out in our politics. We see it playing out in ideas about immigration, about religion, all of these things. And there seems to be a lot of noise.
And in society in general.
Exactly.
And I'm part of that noise. I'm guilty of it too.
I think we all are. And you and I have talked about this before, about how social media makes it very difficult to have a civil conversation.
But you're right. The Second Amendment seems to be a divining rod unlike any others.
Right. And it's seen as a sacred cow. It's something that, you know, we can't ever change. It's, you just have to live with it. You know, you just have to live with the shootings that are happening. And the gun violence that's in our society, and it's just amazing to me that the Second Amendment is this sacred cow.
Yeah.
Now the framers couldn't possibly have imagined the carnage that's been caused by assault weapons such as the AR-15, the AK-47, and other semi-automatic weapons that have these high-capacity magazines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know,
what was the weapon of the day? I mean, isn't like a steel ball and a musket with gunpowder?
It was a musket, and it takes about, you know, the Minutemen literally is that those men could fire and reload a musket in 1 minute. That is the definition of Minuteman.
I either didn't know that or had forgotten it from history class. But
and that's just, okay, one bullet in 1 minute. Yeah. How many bullets in a minute can some of these assault weapons fire?
Yeah.
It's like 600 to 800, depending on who you ask.
I think that the damage at, was it Littleton, Sandy Hook High School? No, literally, I'm getting the shootings mixed up. The Sandy Hook High School, or elementary school, that carnage was over in 6 minutes. The shooting was over in 6 minutes. All those people were killed so quickly. And, yeah, it's nuts. Can I just read the Second Amendment?
Yeah, let's read the Second Amendment as it appears. Now, this does not appear in its entirety in the offices of the NRA in their lobby.
Right, and it has my cold dead hand added at the end.
Right.
I'm quoting here, kids. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed.
That's right.
Aside from being poorly worded and oddly punctuated.
Exactly.
To me, it's a very crystal clear interpretation. I don't know.
I feel really strongly about the well-regulated militia part.
Yeah.
Simply because that seems to be glossed over.
Yeah.
You know, and Veritable Virgo says the government loves its commas and run-on sentences.
Clearly. Clearly.
So, you know, and, you know, it makes it difficult. Because, you know, as you know, we're a nation of laws, and when we try and interpret the law, it can be rather difficult, especially when we have wordings like this. And I don't know, George, if you've seen the Facebook meme that's been going around that says, since the Constitution was written by zero women and zero people of color, I'm pretty sure it could use some updating.
I have seen that. I think that's spot on. I mean, isn't it funny how sometimes the Facebook meme just really sort of nails it? I mean, like, times have changed. Technology has changed. Mass murdering weaponry has changed. You know, what would the framers think if they knew about the atomic weapons of the 60s? To me, it seems like there should be a time in which we revisit these things. I don't think anything should be considered a sacred cow, and I'm not necessarily arguing that we shouldn't have the right to bear arms. Be honest with you, the more I read the Second Amendment, the more to me it says that you don't have a right for a non-militia purpose. You know. But as we've read recently, that's not the case.
That's right. You pointed me towards a Mother Jones article that deals with a case of a court ruling in 2008 of the District of Columbia versus Heller. Now, that court held that the first clause of the Second Amendment that references a militia is a prefatory clause that does not limit the operative clause of the amendment. And additionally, the term militia should not be confined to those serving in the military, because at the time the term referred to able-bodied men who were capable of being called to such a service. And to read the amendment as limiting the right to bear arms only to those in a governed military force would be to create exactly the type of state-sponsored force against which the amendment was meant to protect people.
So I am envisioning the Supreme Court justices around a big chalkboard diagramming a sentence trying to figure out what the fuck this shit means. You know, I mean, a prefatory, mm-hmm. How is the, that's the part I don't agree with. The part that prefatory clause is not germane to or doesn't limit the main clause. I would be with the dissenters on this 2000 8 case. And of course, the NRA love this, although they're pretty concerned right now because of Scalia's untimely passing. I think they feel like this this ruling is on shaky grounds, but I don't think it's as shaky as they think it is. What else did you get out of that article?
Well, I think this particular quote is really telling, and I'm just going to read it. It says, this is from the Mother Jones article. It says, the Second Amendment doesn't say what you think it does.
And for the record, we will put links to these articles and stats that we're pulling up here. We'll put that on northandsouthofthings.com.
And this seems to sum it up. Most judges and scholars who debated the clause's awkwardly worded and oddly punctuated 27 words in the decades before Heller almost always arrived at the opposite conclusion. And finding that the amendment protects gun ownership for purposes of military duty and collective security. It was drafted, after all, in the first years of post-colonial America, an era of scrappy citizen militias where the idea of a standing army like that of the just expelled British evoked deep mistrust. And I think R.T. Cruiser nails it specifically in the chat room. He says it was a reaction against the British and no standing army they wanted the citizens armed should they try an invasion. When a full-time army was formed, the Second Amendment should have been repealed. And I think that's a good point. I mean, sometimes, you know, these, you know, amendments in the Bill of Rights and things come up and they become constitutional law. And it, as you know, it's very difficult to revisit or mm-hmm. change.
Yeah. Nowhere Chrissy, their show's coming up later, the Greetings from Nowhere gang. Definitely want to tune into that. Chrissy says, Alexander Hamilton laid out what a well-regulated militia was in the interpretation. My screen is all messed up here. The founding father was National Guard. They never meant for it to be regular Joes. And that's an interesting aspect because that National Guard is still somewhat under the control of the government. And I think the mistrust that still runs deep in America of its government and its possible tyrannic rule is it's annoying as hell because it never dies. And I think a certain trust and balance and checks and all this kind of stuff, it has to be in order and it's in place. But this deep-rooted sense that government's bad and they're coming for your guns, which, by the way, is totally propagated by NRA. And
oh, absolutely. They're part of their fear-mongering machine.
Yeah, we're going to talk about them in a minute. So Nowhere Chrissy, I have actually never read the Federalist Papers, and I'm embarrassed to admit that, but I really do need to. The older I get, Mark, I swear, I feel like I would rather have studied history. Is that normal?
Well, it's important. Yeah. I think history provides, context, perspective, and a frame of looking at an issue such as this.
I was in history class in college once, and I think it was the history of Western civilization, and the professor asked us the very first day, what is history? And I'm, me always trying to be the smartass. It's just one damn thing after another. And he's like, well, actually, that's about right. I was like, oh, thanks. Mm-hmm. Do we get credit for that? listen, let's talk a little bit. Let's turn a little bit from the Second Amendment and talk a little bit about mass shootings. There's been a number, given what happened last Sunday, in the wee early morning hours of Sunday, to no surprise, there have been a number of very interesting articles, both in Mother Jones and Washington Post, and I believe Esquire has a piece. A lot of articles sort of looking back at all of the mass shootings that have happened in some, predetermined time frame. I found interesting the Washington Post story from the 13th of this month that looks at since 1966, we've had 120 events of where four or more people were killed. By the way, we should preface all this by saying that there doesn't seem to be any universally accepted definition of what a mass shooting is. Everybody calls it something different. It does seem, and this is what I've seen, Mark, and I'm not sure if this is what you've noticed, but it does seem like that 4+ seems to be a definition that a lot of folks stick to.
I think also those 4 people who are killed are not related.
Gotcha.
Or have some sort of strong connection towards each other. Like we had an event recently here in Minnetonka this spring where a father basically came home and killed his entire family and then himself. That isn't counted as a mass shooting simply because the fact that they were all related. So, you know, part of the data is incomplete. You know, what do you include? What do you exclude? And I think we're coming more towards a specific definition.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to start researching some of this stuff. And it's very difficult because there doesn't seem to be a consensus.
Let's put some context here. Thanks, IC Greg. He's talking about a podcast that will read these Federalist Papers to you. That might be good for long drives. Let's see here. All right, so in this article, 126 events where 4 or more people were killed. On average, 7 people died. Each gun that was used during the killing killed an average of 4 people. So obviously each killer had more than one weapon. In these 126 events, 869 victims, there were 869 victims, 144 were children or teenagers. 244 guns were used, and each incident, the killer had an average of 4 weapons. Of those that are known, 140 of those weapons were obtained legally, and 39 were obtained illegally. 129 shooters in all. This one I found astounding, but when you think about it, you're like, yeah, that makes sense. I've never heard of it. But all but 3 were male. All but 3 of those 129 shooters were male.
And I believe they were white males, were they not?
The article didn't specify that, but that would...
But I know there seems to be a lot of opinion and things that are coming out that gun violence seems to be this white male phenomenon.
It has to be predominantly white male. And the only reason I'm saying predominantly because Georgia has had 2. In one of these articles, there's actually a map. And I clicked on Georgia, and there were 2 incidents. One happened in 99 at a day trading place. They call it the Atlanta Day Trading Murders. I think 13 people were killed. And then the one I remember very vividly in the mid-2000s was a guy was on trial for murder, and he got the deputy's gun in court and killed a bunch of people in the court, and then he escaped the courthouse, and there were helicopters flying all over around Midtown because the court was in downtown Atlanta, but he was black. Excuse me, that was the point of that. But I think it's overwhelmingly a white male situation. These 129 shooters were also between the ages of 20 and 49, which I think is interesting. These shootings took place in 40 states and the District of Columbia. You want to guess which state leads the way?
You know what? Let's say California.
Correct, with 21 shootings. And mass shootings, this was also kind of surprising to me. Mass shootings make up less than 0.5% of all gun deaths, which is staggering, I think, when you think about it. Now, we started out by saying there were 126 events since 1966 of 4+ people killed. If you just look at incidents where four or more people were shot, they didn't necessarily die. How about there are 1,052 of those events just from December 2013 to December 2015? So...
Say those dates again, from when to when there were 1,052 incidents?
From December 2013 to December 2015.
That's 2 years, George.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. So we probably shouldn't just be focusing on those who died, because it's an even worse epidemic when you expand it to just look at the total number of shootings. Period. And we all hear it. We all hear it in our daily news, whether it's our town or our city or the neighboring town or city or whatnot. But it's universal. A little bit more statistics. I know we're just sort of rambling off numbers here, but I think it helps set context. So last year, the Congressional Research Service found from 1999 to 2013 that assault rifles, the thing we want banned here, were used in 27% of mass shootings, which it defines as a killing of four or more people in a relatively public place. Dating back to 1982, the rate drops down to 24%. So they looked at how many mass shootings per year before the ban that President Clinton signed in 94, during the ban and after the ban, right? So from 1976 until the ban in 94, there were an average of 18 mass shootings a year. And again, these would be situations where four or more people were killed. During the ban, so from 95 to 2004, when President Bush did not renew the ban, there were an average of 19 incidents a year. So about the same during the ban as before the ban. And after the ban, it spikes up a little bit to, and this is from 2005 to 2011, the average is 21 a year. So it spikes a little bit.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and these numbers don't include, that would be what, 5 years? 2012 through 2016. So we know that in the last handful of years, these incidents would have spiked. So that average has to be considerably higher now. After the ban. And the pro-gun lobby likes to argue that those little set of stats that I just mentioned, the average number of shootings before, during, and after the ban, they like to argue that proves that an assault weapon ban is not going to do any good. But I mean, I don't know about you, Mark, but I feel if it saves one life, it's worth banning. I mean, there's no civilian need for an AK-47, an AR-15, or these high-capacity cartridges. There's no compelling protection reason for that in a civilian situation.
I agree. You know, you've been kind of going over some of the statistics here, but I also kind of want to point out, you know, in recent days it's come to light that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has been effectively hushed on this topic by Congress.
Mm-hmm. Somebody just mentioned that in the chat room, by the way. They were ahead of us a little bit.
And I was listening to the filibuster the other afternoon. I don't know if you were.
Yes.
But you know, to have, you know, our country basically says, you know, there is something happening that we need to take a look at. Like lead in paint, mm-hmm. for example.
Right.
And so the CDC goes to work and they compile data, they go through the research, and they come to conclusion. Here, we have to admit that gun violence is a problem in the United States. I'm sorry, you cannot argue with that fact. We have a problem.
Right.
With gun violence in our country. So I even think the AMA, the American Medical Association, came out this week to basically say that, you know, it's a public health problem.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be one of the top causes of death.
Actually, it is. It's one of the top causes of death in those under the age of 65 in the United States. And there has been no extensive research from the CDC on gun deaths in 15 years.
I mean, that's like, okay, let's say that cancer is a problem and everybody knows somebody who's got cancer or has died from cancer, but the Congress has said we're not going to study it.
That's right. And the problem kind of goes back to 1997 when an amendment was added to an operations bill that passed in Congress with the language that the CDC will be barred from any research that will, quote, advocate or promote gun control.
That's your Republican Congress, kids. Hard
That's
at work.
Right. And it picked up the nickname of the Dickey Amendment. And it was after Representative Jay Dickey, a Republican from Arkansas, who served from 1993 to 2001. And the amendment is often called a ban, while it did allow for research on injuries or deaths from firearms. Congress cut the funding for the CDC by the exact amount that had been spent on gun research in the year before.
So it's death by non-funding.
That's right.
I see.
That if you don't fund it, the problem doesn't exist.
Right.
So in 2012, the language in the Dickey Amendment was expanded to include all aspects of the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the CDC's parent department.
It's unfathomable, I believe is the word I used earlier this week. How can you tell the agency and the department, the U.S. department responsible for making it a healthier place for us to live? How do you deny them the ability, the funding to study this? It's unconscionable is what it is.
It really is. And even the man who lent his name to this amendment has found the lack of CDC research absolutely bone-chilling. And he wrote a joint op-ed piece with Rosenberg in December of 2015 in the Washington Post. And they advocated for more research.
So the guy who the amendment's named for is actually now seeing the error of his ways.
Right, exactly. And here's a quote. "We have also come to see that gun violence research can be created, organized, and conducted with two objectives. First, to preserve the right of law-abiding citizens and legal gun owners, and second, to make our homes and communities safer." Dickey and Rosenberg wrote that well-structured research can be conducted to develop technologies and identify ways to achieve both objectives. Mm-hmm. We can get there only through research.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here we have inaction by Congress. We have no way for the CDC to actually study the issue. And I know from all of the discussion that's been happening in the last week, 6 months, year, 2 years, you know, the President of the United States has had to address the country 18 times in his administration about these mass shootings. And I think, frankly, that the citizens are ready for some change. And they're organizing. And I wanted to mention, because I know I personally have felt rather helpless in change, you know, and I refuse to believe that there's nothing to be done. And there is an organization that is organizing now. It's called everytown.org. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But it has a study released by the U.S. mayors that shows the degree to which the gun lobby is preventing the flow of data on this topic, as well as funding for research. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. But yet, no action has been taken. And you know who is behind that, right, George?
We know exactly who's behind it. Satan, thy name is in the NRA, the National Rifle Association. There was a great PBS series or a episode of Frontline on this week. And actually, I think it was a repeat. I think it's actually from January 2015. It's called Gun Down. If you haven't seen it, I'd highly recommend it. You can watch it on your mobile devices or your computer. It's a great look and I think it's like less than an hour episode. It's a great look at how the NRA got from where they were in the early 60s, which was an entity that was really a membership group for people like Mark in St. Paul, the sportsmen, the hunters, the gun enthusiasts. I mean, it was all about safety. They had little safety training videos, you know. Your mind just goes immediately to that, hey, Tommy, we're going to show you how to use a gun safely today. I mean, that's who they were when they started. I think they had under 500,000 at their peak at that time. They had under 500,000 dues-paying members. But the events of the day changed things in the 60s when John F. Kennedy was killed, when Martin Luther King was killed, when Bobby Kennedy was killed. There was violence in the cities, and the response was one of the first pieces of crime legislation that enacted gun control in 1968. That is when that was the birth. If you have to look at a span of a few years, it's going to be the late 60s to the mid 70s. That is when shit got real at the NRA. All right. They were at in 1977, they were at, there was a bit of a showdown at the OK Corral. It was the NRA's national convention, and there was this sort of dissident group who saw that crime legislation in 1968 as an infringement on their rights of gun ownership. So you had the real ardent, staunch believers in that group. They actually took over at that national convention in 1977. They kind of took over, and that's where it all changed. I mean, after you know, and you can just see this string of things happening. JFK is killed, Martin Luther King is killed, Bobby Kennedy's killed, crime legislation, because of the violence that erupted in these cities after Dr. King was killed and after Bobby and JFK were killed, and so that's when they felt the need for this legislation, and then that's when the real ardent folks feel like they needed to take over.
And there was also another key milestone, and that's after the Reagan shooting. Press Secretary Jim Brady's head wound galvanized an anti-gun group, which paid off under President Clinton. And that resulted in a banning import of assault-style weapons. And that was the assault weapons ban of 1994 and the popular Brady Bill requiring background checks at gun stores.
I remember that. Do you remember being – I remember being in school, and this was – I'm not laughing. It's not funny. But when President Reagan was shot, I remember being in school thinking – because the classroom I was in, they came in and told us what had happened, but they didn't – there wasn't a TV in the room, right?
Right.
And so I kept thinking on the bus ride home, I kept thinking, well, I hope we get to see this on the news, you know. And little did I know that would be one of the first incidents where they would replay and replay and replay and replay President getting shot. That was even spoofed on Saturday Night Live, if you remember early Saturday Night Live days where the president has been shot. Let's go. I mean, they did that over and over again. Anyway, I thought it was ironic that I was thinking, wow, I hope we get to see this on TV. And it turns out they played it every 3 seconds. But yeah, that Jim Brady bill that galvanized a lot of people on the pro gun control side, and was a moment that put the NRA on their heels. But it got kind of testy after that. Wayne LaPierre, who was an early he came into the organization as a lobbyist, and he's not a gun enthusiast himself. He's just a practitioner of of democracy. He began to send out letters that would basically tell, and I'm fast forwarding here a little bit to some of these more recent gun shootings, Columbine, for example. He sent out letters to the membership saying that the government was going to use the Columbine to restrict gun ownership, and like we've seen more recently, gun sales went through the ceiling when people think that their guns are going to be taken away, their gun rights are going to be taken away, and that's the crux of what their most crazed supporters. And I feel bad saying crazed supporter because I know these people feel deeply about they feel passionately about their rights to gun ownership and their ability to keep government at bay with their gun ownership. But I mean, they equate gun ownership with freedom, period. You take away my guns, then you've taken away my sense of freedom, which I think is a little silly. But this Wayne LaPierre guy, I mean, I do have a deep dislike for him. I won't say hate, but I do have a deep dislike for him. He frequently sent out letters that would, and this is, I think, one of the root causes of such a distrust in the government in modern time. One of his letters, fundraising letters, sent out saying that the U.S. government was going to, the jackbooted thugs, was this famous line he used, the jackbooted thugs of the government are going to kick in your door and take your guns and even kill you. And how do you think that kind of shit is going to be read in some of the states where gun ownership is everything, from the Midwest to the South? You know, you threaten to take somebody's gun, and that's not to say people don't feel strongly in the Northeast or the Pacific or the Northwest, but especially in the Midwest and the South, you know. And so it really pissed off the NRA when Clinton got the victories that he did with the assault weapons ban. But the NRA got there, and the NRA had payback when it came time for, and I didn't realize this until I saw it in the Frontline piece. The NRA sort of got their payback because the actual NRA was very instrumental in the defeat of Al Gore and, Lieberman. They sent a huge amount of people to do phone banks and mailers, which at the time that was, you know, that's what you did. And they actually wound up getting, and especially Tennessee, Ohio, and some of the southern states, they actually had state. Oh, Tennessee. Al Gore lost Tennessee, his home state. He lost his home state in the presidential election. And so I actually, and I'm not alone in this, I think their NRA played a big role in having handing George W. Bush. Of course, so did Florida and the Supreme Court, but that's another topic for another day. They've been rooted deeply. And in fact, I love this line from a former NRA executive. Fear is a much greater motivator in American politics than anything else. The fear of losing rights that you perceive you have, that's when groups that represent the issue do well.
You know, George, I think, you know, that really nails it on the head. People are fearful.
It just admitted fear mongering.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, that the NRA's role in the Al Gore defeat by George W. Bush shouldn't be understated. Now, the NRA has beaten this drum for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They are telling us that we live in an unsafe culture and that the only way to feel safe is to own a gun, to carry a gun, to use a gun.
And, you know, I call it, which one of the killings was it that it was unconscionable that they thought that Wayne LaPierre was going to, he scheduled a press conference sort of unexpectedly. And so it was after Sandy Hook. And so everybody thought they were finally going to capitulate on something, you know, and he gets up there and says, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. We're back to Yosemite Sam diplomacy, with all due apologies to Yosemite Sam. But I mean, like, it is, as somebody said in the chat room, I mean, this Wild West mentality, it seems like we're marching back toward that if we're going to be led by these pro-gun rulings that continue to happen. But It's really frightening to me a little bit that this, and in Georgia, we're not going to talk about this issue because that's another topic for another time. But in Georgia, we're dealing with this open carry situation, right? And that these things combined are what frighten me. You know, I talked to a restaurant owner downstairs. I was just trying to take the temperature of a few people about what they think about gun rights and assault weapons ban. And to a T, everybody seems to feel, as I think is the majority of America, that I believe in gun ownership. People should have the right to own a gun, but there's absolutely no reason for an assault weapon to be owned in a non-civilian situation. And this guy, you know, we then started talking about the open carry situation, and he told a story that it wasn't his restaurant, it was at another restaurant, and this guy was upset that his food wasn't prepared the way he wanted it prepared, and he sent it back, and it came back, and it was still mad, and so he got more vocal and more loud. The guy reaches down and moves his shirt so that you could see he's carrying a gun. Takes the gun out of the whole holster, right, clipped from his belt, sets it on the table, and looks, and says, I want to talk to the manager. Now, what kind of threatening bullshit is that?
It's terrible.
Yeah, we better not get into that open carry situation. That's another topic for another time. In my opinion, I feel like the NRA has done more to create distrust between the government and its citizens. And I think it's time that we stop. We have to stop them. In what way? And it's frustrating.
Well, you know, it's been shown that the NRA's role in, you know, lobbying efforts in Congress, there's a lot of information that's coming out that which representative and which senator is taking money from the NRA. Find out, this is what's so frustrating, is that this gun lobby is so powerful that there is a frustrating lack of federal response to this. And, you know, when 20 kids in an elementary school are gunned down, is not a tipping point. What is? You know, and even in the wake of Gabby Gifford's shooting, President Obama advisors told him that the political price for proposing gun control was too great. There is nothing more to be done. And I think that idea is still in effect.
Was the Gabby Giffords shooting before his second
I believe
election?
So.
Okay. So that's why his advisors are saying the price is too high. Yeah.
Right. And the NRA is described as the best equipped, most feared interest group on Capitol Hill. Their organization is a well-oiled machine that controls what our legislators say and do on this particular topic, and hence the lack of any federal action since 1994.
I see Greg says we are a generation away from people believing that the NRA's role in Congress is constitutional. That's a frightening prospect. I don't understand. I guess it's the desire to continue in office. So if you you desire to stay in office, so one, you get money; two, you get votes, because they can rock, as they've proven, they can rock the vote and have people voted out. Look what happened to Joe Manchin, right, in West Virginia. Democrat, but a strong gun owner, came out, and this is in the Frontline piece. If you turn on them, they will find a way to get you out of office.
I see Greg says that Giffords was shot in 2011.
Oh, so that would have been, that would be in his first term. Yeah. Okay. I don't know, Mark, what do we need to do? Because I think, you know, what's going on in your state? Are you guys talking? Are you hearing legislation?
Well, you know, there was an attempt to get some legislation in the last legislative session about universal background checks. Now, we used to have this, and then it was removed from a piece of legislation a couple of years ago, and it hasn't been able to be put back. And Minnesota is a concealed carry state. So it's really difficult. And now my Minnesota House Representative, Betty McCollum, has basically had enough And so Senator Al Franken, who's mm-hmm. also Minnesota,
right,
you know, participated in the recent filibuster. And, you know, this gives me a little bit of hope that the Senate is wanting to force the issue. And it's not about taking guns away. Mm-hmm. It's about sensible reform.
Well, you know what? And I worry about the House, because I think it does feel like it's possible that they'll finally take up a vote on some of these things. And I think, you know, the background checks, banning the high capacity magazines and the assault style. If we had those three things, it would be amazing. We've got about 4 minutes left, it looks like. What do you think people can do, in your opinion? Talk to me about this Everytown thing.
Well, everytown.org, and that's the website, is an organization that is using mothers against drunk driving. They're using their playbook.
Ah.
And these mothers of families and of children are studying...
Oh, dear. You know, are you okay?
I'm fine.
Do you have a gun?
No, I don't.
Sorry.
They're organizing out of this Mothers Against Drunk Driving playbook.
Yeah.
And they're starting to get some traction. Now, there's a Minnesota organization. There's a Minnesota chapter. And it's organizing legislative days in the legislature. They're asking people to call, write, email, tweet your legislators, and get involved. And if you're not sure how to do that, you know, you should consider joining everytown.org. And there's a quote here. Everytown is a movement of Americans working together to end gun violence and build safer communities. Gun violence touches every town in America. For too long, change has been thwarted by the Washington gun lobby and by leaders who refuse to take common sense steps that will save lives. But something is changing. More than 3 million mayors, moms, cops, teachers, survivors, gun owners, and everyday Americans have come together to make their own communities safer. Together, we are fighting for the changes that we know will save lives. Every town starts with you, and it starts in your town. And once again, that website is www.everytown.org.
You know, it occurs to me that could be a great model. And I think every single one of us who has said we should not have assault weapons, everybody who has said that in the chat room should make it a personal pledge to go check that website out or go call your senator. Leave a voicemail. They're not working on the weekends. They're not working when they're working, but that's another story. Pledge to do something. Pledge to make a call. Send an email. Look at everytown.org. Consider joining. Consider doing something. Mark and I felt passionately about coming to this conversation today to not lament and shed more tears over the loss of life in Orlando, but to do something. So I hope that you'll take from this conversation the need to pick up a pen or that cell phone, call somebody. Mark, we'll leave it there. We got to go.
That's right. Take care, George. Let's have some action.
That's right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The North and South of Things. More information available at northandsouthofthings.com. Follow Mark on Twitter at Laughing Buddha. That's LaffingBuddha. And George at George in Atlanta. Our podcast theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.